The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Where are we, Lionel?
Well, Richard, we're at the Vermouteria again in London's King's Cross, and we should really have mentioned the Vermouth cycling crossover last week when we were here. We were very kindly presented with a glass of complimentary vermouth after we'd finished recording
two
the podcast.
Glasses, one each.
One
even.
Each, yeah, we didn't have to share. Now, Carpano, there's a few cycling bits of memorabilia inside, the bar, cafe. Carpano is a producer of vermouth based in Turin, sponsored a cycling team in the late 50s and early 60s, wore black and white stripes, very much like Juventus, the football team, also from Turin. And Franco Balmanian won the Giro twice for the Carpano team in 62 and 63. Cinzano also sponsored a cycling team in the 1970s and into the early 80s, I think. But my favourite vermouth doesn't have a cycling connection. It's a French vermouth from Marseille and down in the south of France, not far from Sète, Noilly Prat. I believe you pronounce a T on the end of Noilly Prat. And that's maybe they'll come into cycling. Well, they can't, can they? Because obviously alcohol is banned from sponsoring cycling teams now.
Not so banned for sponsoring
only
a cycling podcast.
Only in certain countries, napalm.
Really?
France, certainly.
In France, yeah. That's called the Loi Evin, which is the which bans the advertising of alcohol brands. That's why, for example, we don't get champagne on the Tour de France podium.
Of course. Well, that means
Daniel
it's a de facto ban.
Can I finish my introductions? I mean,
sorry.
So that's Lionel Burney. I'm Richard Moore, and that's Daniel Freeb just chipped in there in the Vermouth podcast.
I should say, Rich, on that particular subject, we got a cracking email from a gentleman called Matt Brass, or Brass, from the Albourne Estate Winery, with some information about vermouth. Further to my comments last week, I don't really know enough about vermouth to comment on the issue at the moment, until such point where I can legitimately consider myself a vermouth snob, and that remains the case. I've not managed to swat up, I've not found the time this week, but maybe next week.
No, but thanks, Matt, for the email. It's certainly a good starting point for Daniel in his efforts to educate himself on vermouth.
Well, we were recording late morning last week, weren't we? And the vermouth, it's an aperitif. It's sort of an early evening drink just before dinner, really.
I didn't see you turn it down, Lionel.
I didn't turn it down. I was just being polite.
Any cycling news this week at all?
Loads
going on in
news.
Cycling world?
Richard, the busiest week of the year so far. Do feel free to chip in during the news roundup. We're going to discuss opening weekend in Belgium in a bit more detail in the first part of this podcast, but in brief, De Koninck Quickstep did the double at the weekend, winning Omloop Het Nieuwsblad with Zdeněk Stybar, and then Kern Brussels Kern with Bob Jungels, and then they added Le Samin on Tuesday. Florian Seneschal, French rider, made it three cobbled classics out of three in quick succession. Daniel, Seneschal is on course to win the 2024 Paris-Roubaix, as you've long predicted. Is that right?
Well, I was going to say, Lionel, I think I first tipped Florian Seneschal to win Paris-Roubaix in about 1973, which I think was about 15 years before he was born. But yeah, I tip him every single year, don't I?
I'm kind of not sure what reaction we can expect from his girlfriend if he wins Paris-Roubaix, given her response to him winning Le Samin, because she was fairly happy, quite over-the-top celebrations, I felt, for, I mean, an important race, a big race, but
it was certainly the most important race on Tuesday.
Certainly the most important race for him as well.
Yeah, yeah.
It was her birthday, Rich.
Oh, sorry, I missed that. Okay.
Ah, well, good for him. So that's three out of three for De Koninck Quickstep on the cobbles. Quite a few stories thrown up by the weekend's racing. Most notably, the women's Omloop Het Nieuwsblad had to be stopped when breakaway rider Nicole Hanselman of the Bigler team got very close to catching the men's race, which had been set off ahead of the women, but clearly not far enough ahead. The women's race was then neutralised. Hanselman set off again, followed by the bunch who eventually caught her. And the race was won by Dutch rider Chantal Black ahead of Marta Bastianelli of Italy, who then won the Omloop Van Het Hagelen the following day. Now, this was I'd not been to Omloop Het Nieuwsblad for a few years, and this was the first time that they'd integrated the start and finish, or the first time I'd seen them do this. The team presentation was all integrated in the centre of the famous track in Ghent. When I looked at the schedules, you know, the slowest men's schedule and the fastest women's schedule, there was only 10 minutes apart in the first kind of hour of racing. The women were due to ride over the Lieberg, and then after the Lieberg pull off the course and make their own way to the finish. But the men were really dawdling when we first saw them. They just pootled past us after probably 30 kilometres on their way to the Lieberg, and that caused a problem, really. Lots of reaction to this, because people were asking, well, why couldn't they stop the men's race and let the women pass? Well, the simple reason for that is it would have made the logistics for the rest of the day. It would have turned a bad situation into a chaotic and probably catastrophic one, because the chances are the men may well have caught them up. Probably what they should have done, and I don't get the sense that anyone in the men's race really knew that the women were closing in, because there was no instruction from the commissar to the team sports directors to say, look, the women's race is in danger of catching you up, can you get your guys to press on a bit, which would have been probably the sensible response. And I think this is an unintended consequence of trying to do the right thing and integrate the two races and increase the profile of the women's race by holding it on the same day, having the start and finish in the same place, and using largely the same course. The problem is, you know, this races take place in the real world out on public roads that are open to traffic, and I suspect, and from my questioning on the following morning, the consensus was that they can't just close the roads, you know, for sort of 45 minutes to an hour. They want to keep the road closure sensible for the general population. So that's where the problem arose.
We're going
to
talk about this a bit more on the cycling podcast Femina next week, and we've got an interview with Hanselman in that episode. And it spawned a lot of stories in the press, didn't it, about, you know, the women catching the men. It's a great headline. That's not entirely an accurate sort of reflection of what happened, really, or how how road racing works.
The women's race was 77 kilometres shorter than the men. Yeah, and over the course of it, they're 4 kilometres an hour slower. I mean, it's apples and oranges.
I would say as well, in sort of in defence of the organisers, that what happened has become very unusual, that races have not tended to run the way that Het Nieuwsblad ran, where they did allow the break this huge lead and they did dawdle along. That's been quite unusual. That goes against the recent pattern where average speeds over the whole race have been higher and breaks have not been allowed that sort of gap. So quite a lot of unusual things going on there, which created this unfortunate situation. But I watched the women's race, and frankly, the women were stopped and asked to pause for a bit. They didn't seem that bothered about it or angry about it. And that happens sometimes in bike races for all kinds of reasons. It could be a level crossing. Actually, they stopped them just before a level crossing, and I thought this could be interesting if they start them again and the level crossing comes down between the breakaway and the bunch. But they moved them then beyond the level crossing and restarted the race. But these things do happen from time to time. And as I say, we'll talk about it a bit more, I think, next week.
Yeah, there was another at the Kern Brussels Kern Junior race. I don't know whether you saw the little video on social media of the start of the race in the neutralised section. Suddenly, the lead commissar's car braked, and a couple of dozen riders crashed into the back of the car, obviously not expecting the lead car to brake suddenly. From reports, it seems that the car's automatic braking kicked
in. This happened with Cavendish, didn't it? Last year.
That's right, yeah.
Mm. At the Dubai Tour, was it last year?
Yeah.
UAE Tour.
Yeah. So the automatic braking cut in when the riders, frankly, pulled alongside the car and the sensors slammed on the anchors. Probably want to disable that function on the car for if you're driving a...
We shouldn't laugh because it looked quite nasty.
Yeah, I mean, it was... But again, you know, this is the thing, isn't it? There's a lot of anger on social media, but mistakes do happen. I mean, a bike race, mistakes happen all day, every day, and sometimes, particularly when you're out on the course in these races, you do get that sort of sense of the fear that the whole thing is happening by the seat of its pants, really. The vehicles, the motorbikes, the public. And we see these kind of incidents all the more because everyone's filming everything, and you know, they get the publicity of social media. Anyway, finishing up in Belgium, there were some crashes over the weekend, but probably the highest profile one was Lotto Soudal's Thijs Benoot, who crashed in Het Nieuwsblad, and it's touch and go for Strada Bianchi at the weekend. He's the defending champion there in Italy, but we don't know at this point whether he will be fit to take the start. He seemed optimistic at on Sunday, and well, we shall wait and see. Other racing, the UAE Tour concluded in Dubai and was won by Primoz Roglic of Jumbo Visma. Roglic won. He led from start to finish. He won the penultimate stage. The day before that, Caleb Ewan had won a very punchy finish at Hatterdam, which was a surprise to me, but having listened to a forthcoming interview we've got with Caleb Ewan, perhaps not such a surprise to see him win on a finish like that. The final stage was won by Ireland's Sam Bennett of Bora Hansgrohe, an impressive victory for him because he beat Fernando Gaviria and Caleb Ewan, who've both been banging form. You may have heard Daniel's interview with Bennett from the training camp at the start of the season. He's obviously very disappointed that he's unlikely to ride either the Giro or the Tour, but if he keeps winning races, he might force his way in somehow. Who knows?
Tour of Austria. Cruel, Richard.
Two former Tour de France stage winners have been in good form at the weekend in the south of France. Lilian Calmejean won the Classic d'Ardèche and Alexis Vuillemoz won the Drôme Classic. Track racing, to delight Daniel, the World Track Championships in Pruszków, Poland. Netherlands and Australia both won 6 gold medals. The Netherlands topped the medal table by virtue of more silver medals. But the big stories were the Australian quartet of Sam Welsford, Kelland O'Brien, Lee Howard and Alex Porter broke the world record in the team pursuit with a 3:48.012 in the final. Lightning quick, considering that Pruszków track is not one of the quickest in the world, or not thought to be one of the quickest.
Last time I saw Lee Howard was making a coffee at the Vuelta.
I was about to say, Rich, yeah. It's not a great advert for indoor cycling, is it, that you can be
a barista 1 minute
by day and an elite track indoor pursuing demon.
Well,
by
yeah, yeah, but he opened a cafe in Andorra. I went to it during the Vuelta, when the Vuelta went to Andorra, and he was sort of spending a lot of the summer there, but the winter focus for him was definitely training and on the track.
Well, it's paid off, certainly. They beat Great Britain in the final, and the Great Britain quartet were no slouches either, because they did 3:50.810, which is not a slow time. The Australians also won the women's team pursuit with Annette Edmondson, Ashley and Kudinoff, Georgia Baker and Amy Cure. They also beat Great Britain in the final. Another few little stories from the track worlds that caught my eye. Roger Kluger, who finished the UAE tour for Lotto Soudal,
got up
the next morning, flew to Europe and arrived at the track 3 hours before the Madison, teamed up with his German teammate Theo Reinhardt, and won the gold medal in rainbow jersey.
That was incredible. I mean, I couldn't believe it.
That's a sort of Jacques Anquetil, Dauphiné, Bordeaux, Paris, back-to-back story.
He was also pretty busy at the UAE tour. You know, he was doing a lot. He was quite visible working for Caleb Ewan. So I was astonished at that, yeah.
Yeah, so well done him. Filippo Ganna of Italy, who rides for the Team Sky on the road, won the individual pursuit. And Kirsten Wild of the Netherlands won the Omnium and Madison, the Madison with Amy Peters. But the one that got away was a scratch race. Now, I saw that and there was a big crash with about a lap or so to go, wiped out nearly everybody. And Eleanor Barker of Great Britain beat Kirsten Wild in the sprint. Away from the racing, the other big story of the week, and we'll talk about this in the third part of today's podcast, the big blood doping story that's coming out of Austria. Started with a police raid on some cross-country skiers, I think it was, and has snarled up some cyclists. So far we know about Stefan Denifil, who won a stage for the 2017 Vuelta for Aqua Blue and had signed for the CCC team for this season, but pulled out of that contract late last year citing personal reasons. He confessed to blood doping in a police interview, and then the following day another Austrian rider, George Preidler of Groupama FDJ, who was a member of Tom Dumoulin's Giro-winning Sunweb team in 2017. He's also confessed to doping, although he says he only recently started dabbling in doping and it didn't influence or affect his previous races. You're raising an eyebrow there, Richard.
Wow.
But quite. Well,
lots more to say on that story, though, later on in the podcast.
Lots more, yes. And finally, former Team Sky and Great Britain doctor, Dr. Richard Freeman, he's been subject to a hearing by the General Medical Council in Manchester. It's been adjourned, possibly for quite a few months now, after almost a month of behind closed doors legal argument. The case centres on the delivery of some testosterone to British Cycling headquarters. Not expecting any resolution to this case anytime soon, possibly not even before the end of the year. But we will follow that as it unfolds.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thanks very much indeed to our headline sponsor, Rafa. Now, Rafa, as we speak, are launching Rafa Custom, which is an online kit design tool. Basically allows you to design your own kit. Lionel, you've been playing around with this, and you come up with a really snazzy design there.
Well,
while we've been talking.
I've gone for the whole colour palette. I've chosen different colours for as many different colours as possible. I've managed to get, I think, 11 colours on a jersey design. Oh, I've closed it down now, but it's good fun.
It looked quite fetching, that. I mean, it is quite good fun. I've been doing it as well.
Yeah.
I'm not so
sure. It's like colouring in, isn't it?
Yeah. I tried to... That you can put a logo on the breast there. I tried to put my passport picture. That didn't work.
I mean, this is the stuff of nightmare, the cycling jersey with your big face on it. And quite rightly, the Rafa Custom doesn't allow you to upload images like that for your own good, really. But, you can really, within the parameters, you can have all sorts of different stripes, horizontal stripes, vertical stripes, different colours on the sleeve, different colours on the back. Yep. I can see people getting quite inventive with
Stand out from the crowd. Go to rafa.cc to have a look at that. Discounts up to 40% on big orders, so definitely worth doing if you're a club or doing a particular event or something, I would think. Rafa.cc for more information. Now, you're just back, Lionel, from Belgium. We sat here a week ago in glorious sunshine predicting a weekend of fine weather in Flanders, and it didn't quite work out like that, did it?
No, well, the weather forecast on last Tuesday when we recorded, or was it Wednesday, it looked like it was going to be bright and sunny in Flanders, but then by the weekend that had changed, and it was cold. And it rained a fair bit on Sunday at Kern, Brussels Kern. Typical opening weekend weather, really, and typical opening weekend racing. I've made a Friends of the Podcast special called Opening Weekend, which is online now for 2019 Friends of the Podcast, just capturing
a listen to that
flavor.
This morning, Lionel.
Any good?
Really enjoyed it.
Oh,
yeah,
that's nice.
It was great. And there were two things that really stood out for me. One of them was Matt Heyman's story about his first ever race, and not a story I didn't know. Well, I don't want to spoil it. When he turned up for his first race, he didn't get out of the car because he was scared.
You've spoiled it.
Yeah, well, I'll not say why he was scared.
Okay. Yeah,
you got to listen to find out why he was scared. There's a very specific and really fascinating reason.
Yeah,
but I remember the other story that jumped out now, but if it comes back to me, I'll mention it.
Listen to it again, Rich. The two races were great, I thought, and De Koenig Quickstep did the double. They've not done that before. It's not been done by the same team since the mid-80s, I don't think. I'd have to double-check that. I think in the mid-80s.
You're supposed to do that before we record.
Yeah, I know. Sorry, I can't check everything before we record. But Stenyx D-Bar won... Well, this is the question I was going to ask. Is that the biggest one-day race win of his career? He's won Strada Bianca before.
He's not won a lot, has he?
And he's won the national title, the Czech national title. Is Omloop Het Nieuwsblad or Strada Bianca the bigger race now? It's probably, they're probably on a par, aren't they? But it was an impressive finish. He was in the final group of five with Greg Van Avermaet, twice winner, of course, Tim Wellens, Dylan Turns, and the Kazakh rider Alexei Lutsenko, who's fresh from dominating the Tour of Oman, of course. And, well, the finale was quite interesting. Tim Wellens may as well have had a massive sign above his head. I'm stealing your...
I was stealing it from somebody else. But, yeah, I mean, I read in a football report somebody signposts a move so clearly that they might as well have rented an aeroplane and had a banner flying across the stadium. But, yeah, Tim Wellens' move was signposted pretty well. I mean, there was a traffic island that they were approaching, and he was tightening his shoes and went up the wrong side of the road to try and get that advantage of the the road splitting in two.
And then Stibar, basically, not long after that, kind of countered. And
well, the problem with Van Avermaet as well was clearly the fancied rider and the rider who fancied himself. And he was, you know, he was trying at every opportunity to force a split. And again, signposting the fact that he was the strongest and felt the strongest. And so he was the guy, he shouldn't have been, but he was the guy that closed the gap to Wellens, and then Stibar went over the top.
Yeah. Talking about riders who fancy themselves, Rich, I heard a good story a couple of weeks ago about there being a classic specialist. I'm going to give away his nationality, a Belgian classics specialist who is known as the world champion with no stripes because he apparently quite rates himself. However, that's not Greg Van Avermaet, and indeed this particular rider wasn't really in the shake-up the other day.
Interesting. Wonder who that is. Send us your top 18 potential candidates.
On Napalm, just on the mix of riders in that winning group or in that front group at the end, I thought it was quite curious in the sense that there were three riders who you wouldn't necessarily associate with cobbled classics. Those riders being Toynes, Wellens, and Lutsenko. I mean, in Lutsenko's case, I think it's probably something that he's developing and will develop in terms of his abilities and his repertoire of skills. But Toynes is certainly someone you associate more with the Ardennes classics, longer, steeper climbs, and Wellens as well, to a certain extent. I don't know whether this is just due to the time of year and the fact that the big boys haven't really come out to play yet, or whether that hints at sort of the future direction of those two guys' careers.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, Wellens, of course, was possibly benefited in the sense that his teammate Benoot was a faller with around 30 kilometres to go, so we're kind of out of the picture, and that would have, you know, if there had been any sort of hierarchy, you would have thought that Benoot would be the team leader in a race like Het Nieuwsblad, but then once he's out of the picture, that frees up Wellens. I think it's about form, isn't it? I mean, Van Avermaet's been good so far. Lutsenko, very good in Oman. Tim Wellens has won a few races already. So, you know, these races rely, if you're strong, you're strong.
And the way that Van Avermaet was riding almost looked to me like he was using it almost for training as well, because the efforts he was making on the climbs, you know, if they worked, great, he could have won the race, but it looked to me as though there was a sort of other purpose for him there than just trying to win.
No surprise that the races to come, particularly the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix, are the priorities for Van Avermaet. I spoke to Jim Okovic of CCC after the race, and they were happy with his condition, a bit disappointed with the result. And I was a little bit surprised that Okovic was saying that they've not thought any further than Paris-Roubaix for Van Avermaet, because I thought, well, Peter Sagan, notably not at Het Nieuwsblad, because he is, we think, targeting Liège-Bastogne-Liège with its new finish. And if a finish suits Sagan, you would think that the course would suit Van Avermaet. But the CCC team are focusing at the moment on the Cobble Classics, and then I guess we'll take it, you know, see what sort of form he's in, what condition he's in after those races.
Are we going to hear from Toynes?
Yeah, we can hear from Dylan Toynes, who was in that move at the finish. He finished fifth out of five, riding for Bahrain Merida. Now, Stibar, you mentioned he countered, basically, with around about 2.5 kilometres to go, went in a very similar place to Michael Valgren, who won from a bigger group last year, but went and held off the rest of the riders from sort of 2.5 kilometres to go. I asked Dylan Toynes what was going through his mind when did he feel like he had a 1 in 5 chance of winning.
Of course, was really happy that I was there on the Mur. The Bosberg was a bit of surviving or keeping like the strongest guys the wheels of the strongest guys, like Stibar and Greg, they saw were really strong there, and I had to stay with them, don't lose too much, and this worked well finally. But then there was still a long way to go, and you feel like Lutsenko and they could still make some big efforts there in the front. I tried to save a little bit of energy for the last really 3K, like the really final. And in the end, the attack of Wellens was the first opener. But then, when they catched him, the speed fell down. And yeah, Stieber made directly the attack, and yeah, he was gone. You saw directly he was gone.
Did you know that Stibar attacked in a very similar place to Valgren from last year?
Must be now I realize it was like after the 3K, and must be more or less the same time.
And finally, Van Avermaet started to maybe work, but then when he sat up, you then lifted it. Chance to bring back?
No, you know, like in that moment, you know who was going to close the gap would lost the race, so... That's the problem. Like at that moment, who's closing is losing the race. So anyway, you could directly see Stibar was gone.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Lacca. Now, Lacca is a smarter way of insuring your bikes and gear. It's a community of cyclists joining together to play fair and take good care to save each other money. Lacca covers all the basics, theft, accidental loss and damage, both at home and abroad. It also covers you in sportives and races, as long as you're not riding in the pro peloton. Now, Richard, you're not riding in the pro peloton.
No.
You've signed up with Lacca, haven't you?
Yeah, I got a new bike a couple of weeks ago. Bought myself a new bike one of the first things I did, having heard about them through the cycling podcast, was I signed up and registered it with Lacca, yeah.
So you're fully covered?
Fully covered.
Excellent. Well, the idea is that instead of charging a fixed premium, you only pay a small share of the community's claim costs. Your share is proportionate to how much gear you're insuring with Lacca. And while your share can theoretically go down to zero if there are no claims in a month, Lacca also locks in a maximum price to make sure that there are no nasty surprises when you get your insurance bill. So even in months with lots of claims, you're not going to have a suddenly elevated bill. Claims are accepted quickly, usually within a day, but don't take our word for it. Let's hear from one of Lacca's customers who had to make a claim while riding his bike on holiday.
Is it reassuring that they understand bicycles and cycling? Yeah, it is. I like the fact that they're very specialist. I like the fact they're very focused on this and they understand the market. I'm Philip Meyer. I've been a Lacca customer since about April 2018. I am training for a big ride this year to ride the Maratona Dolomite. Their whole model is predicated around paying out rather than retaining money. I think it's good that they understand the market and they understand why people are likely to claim. I really like the fact that they've got a community, a crowdsource feel around this. I like the way that the insurance is structured, but I also like the fact that they are out organizing rides, they're out creating this Facebook group, they're out doing events, and that you actually get to meet the people, speak to the actual people in person, and that there's a face to this, not just a big corporate who is just out to make money.
So if you want to be like Richard and you're new to Lacca, you can get a £10 credit by signing up today with the discount code podcast. Find out more about Lacca at lacca.co.uk. That's lacca.co.uk.
I just wish I'd known about the discount code.
Oh, Richard. Maybe they can apply it retrospectively. Well, the winner of Het Nieuwsblad, Rich, was Stibar. Polished it off. Last year's string of results in the classics were impressive, lots of top 10 finishes, but always the bridesmaid, never the bride, really, in those races. We've seen him crash at unfortunate moments in Paris-Roubaix before, and you know, the sense from his press conference afterwards was that he was perhaps starting to think that a Belgian classic was never going to come his way. Big win for De Koninck Quickstep, because the pressure's always on them for these races, and well, maybe the fact that they got the first win on Saturday, well, it certainly freed up Bob Jungels for Kern Brussels Kern on the following day. And if anything, that was an even more impressive victory, because he went with 15 kilometres to go, one lap of the finishing circuit, and looked very, very strong to hold off the chase. But the most remarkable thing about that chase was the Jumbo-Visma riders were on the front chasing to try and bring it back together for Dylan Groenewegen, who won last year, of course. And then a pack of Quickstep, De Koninck Quickstep riders came up to the front and pretty much bullied them off the front and said, no, don't chase. And Jumbo-Visma went,
it was
oh,
amazing
all right then.
To watch, because you had Jan Pedruca as well there chasing, and but when there was somebody on the front chasing, the Quickstep, the Koenig Quickstep guys just got behind them and formed a block of four or five riders, and that's what it looked like. It looked like they were bullying other teams out of chasing.
Any beef about that, Napalm?
I don't think so. I mean, what, from the Jumbo-Visma riders?
Well, from any number of teams, really, whose chase was impeded. I mean, we have seen teams obviously do that before. We've certainly seen individual riders from teams, or maybe even a couple of riders, sort of insert themselves into the line and make it difficult for a chase to be organised. But I don't think I've seen a full team lineup like that before.
No, I mean, it was intimidating, wasn't it? I mean, but the thing is, I think this is one of the great uncovered aspects of cycling, but also professional sport. The sort of the sense of stature, status, intimidation, sledging even, you know, mind games, talking people out of a position of strength, nudging people out of a position of strength. I mean, positioning and presence are absolutely critical in these races, and I mean, it was a pretty awesome show of strength, but you either stand your ground or you melt away. I mean, I watched it a couple of times. I don't get the feeling that De Koenig Quickstep did anything that was out of order. They did something that was intimidating, but I mean, they didn't deny space. They didn't argy-bargy their way to the front. They just massed at the front, waved their arms a bit to say slow down, and the rest of the bunch acquiesced.
And it made a difference, because Jungels looked like he was hanging on. It was windy, it was hard. It is traditionally a race that ends in a bunch sprint, although Jesper Stuyven a couple of years ago did a similar thing. But Jungels, his lead was, you know, going to the last few kilometres, his lead, he was hanging by a thread, really, and it looked like it would come back, but it was a tired group behind as well. It had been a tough day, and you know, it could be that the other teams didn't quite have the numbers that De Koenig and Quickstep had to organise a chase or to counter the guys that they had that were fresh enough to be at the front. We should mention that Owain Doull, who was you know, his first really notable result of his road career, he finished second, jumping away at the end. There were a few disqualifications as well for riding on cycle paths, and he drifted right off the kind of road in the finishing straight, and then sort of popped around the advertising hoardings again, and I wondered if he might get in trouble for that, but no, he held on and a very good second
place. Well, he was riding on the road, wasn't he? I mean, it was just wet, the shape of the barriers there.
I couldn't tell whether there was a cycle path at the side of the road or not. I don't know.
Well, it was a hugely impressive performance by Doull, though, wasn't it? I mean, last year, sort of midway through last year, it looked as though his future with Team Sky might be certainly, if not in jeopardy, then in question. I remember at the Tour of Yorkshire last year, they kind of gave him the leadership role, and he didn't really take the opportunity, didn't ride particularly well there, and I was not surprised, but curious to see that they'd given him another contract later on in the year, and he certainly looks as though he's going to set about justifying that.
He rode well. I mean, apart from at the finish, he was active earlier on as well in a little move. So, yeah.
It's always different. I mean, it was a very impressive jump away. But could you do that if it was first place up for grabs with a team on the front leading it out, with Groenewegen and giving it everything for the sprint? Probably not. It doesn't necessarily follow that because you got second place in that manner, you could get first place in that manner. But nevertheless, it was a decisive move and a good result. You know, one that you can put on the CV and point to at the end of the year. Just on the disqualifications, Rich, Niels Pollitt of Katusha was disqualified. But Matteo Trentin wasn't disqualified.
Oh, okay, I thought he
was. I don't think he was. He was just a DNF because he was caught off the back. And he went on a cycle path. From what I gather, the issue is whether or not it endangers spectators. And Niels Pollitt's move was judged to be perhaps the wrong other side of a line of spectators or whatever. It's a bit like what I was talking about last week. The application of these rules is very much in the eyes of the judge and jury, isn't it? They see what's what and they make a decision.
Funny old sport cycling, isn't it, where the women catch the men enough to stop and wait, and then the cyclists get disqualified for riding on cycling paths. Well, explain this to a newcomer.
Yeah, well, indeed. Just before we move away from Belgium, had we ought to mention the controversy over the poster to promote the Bink Bank E3
Harald Becker. What was E3 Harald Becker? Whatever it's called now.
One of the few of these spring Belgian races that isn't organised and run by Flanders Classics, the company which has really hoovered up the bigger one-day races in the region. Now, they've had trouble in the past over, frankly, sexist posters to promote their race. One year they had some little cyclists riding over basically a naked woman. And this year's poster, I didn't mention it in last week's news roundup, frankly, because felt like it was giving the oxygen of publicity to something that was just a bit naff and a bit
doing
crap.
Their marketing for them.
Doing their marketing for them, yeah. But because the UCI have now commented, feel like we ought to mention it. The UCI have basically told the race organisers to take the poster down from their social media. Now, when I first saw it, I really had to squint to try and see what the fuss was about, because it was, to me, my eyes, it was like one of those magic eye posters. I couldn't quite see what it actually was, but it is basically two body-painted women, the image of a frog, and the inference is that the winner of the E3 race, the prize is... what is the prize? I mean, I don't know. What's it? What is...
I don't really understand the poster at all.
It just...
It's beyond me.
It's just tiring, really, is my response to it. It's just it's kind of unnecessary for the race organisers. Clearly designed to generate some kind of buzz and fuss, but it's generating the wrong sort of buzz and fuss, certainly outside of Flanders. The UCI have said, take it off social media, but driving around Waregem as we were on... Sunday, where the race, as we were coming back, where the race, the E3 race takes place, it's on enormous billboards. It's on the side of factories. It's everywhere. It's on roundabouts.
And is it easier to make out what it is when you see it on a billboard?
Not really. It just looks like a frog.
A frog.
And then you get very close, and you still can't quite see it, and then you've gone past it. Anyway, it's...
Yeah, it's a strange one for the UCI to get involved, but they have they've threatened legal action unless they remove the... The image. They,
again, going back to the thing about littering from last week, the UCI introducing a rule about littering that's about as clear as mud, introducing the rule about the cycle path, when's a DQ, when isn't a DQ, and this, just have a clearly written rule about race promotional material and say what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable, rather than getting involved after the fact on one.
What would that look
example.
Like, Napalm? What would that look like in this case?
Because I've no idea.
You talk about interpretation of the law about pavements, and you know the wording in that is probably something to the effect of endangering spectators. But you know that in itself is a subjective concept. What is endangering spectators? What is offensive? In a regulation about a race poster, it's a tricky one.
But it's offensive to some people and probably not a big deal to other people. But you could just say, look, no promotional material that involves naked or scantily clad or body painted women. Simple. Done.
My brother, who is a nature photographer, does paint people, men and women, in body paint as frogs, because he to highlight the plight of endangered frogs. But I don't think that's what the E3 poster is helping to promote at all.
But it kind of, it does, and having spent the weekend in Belgium and just reacquainting myself with these races, it's so obvious that the whole region, this whole cycling culture of the region exists in microcosm, really. I mean, it is, you know, as far as the Belgians are concerned, Omloop Het Nieuwsblad is the first proper race of the season, and the
actually this reminds me of the second most eye ear catching bit of your episode, Lionel, because it was your interview with Hugo Kurowitz and the extent of the coverage of the race in Het Nieuwsblad, the paper that he works for. 100 page supplement the week before Het Nieuwsblad, and then 12 to 20 pages a day. Yep. On the race they had 20 journalists and photographers at Het Nieuwsblad on the day. That was all really fascinating, and we know it, but it's just to hear it is extraordinary.
Yeah, and they are a big deal, and you know you do get the feeling in spring that if the cycling season ended with Paris-Roubaix, no one in Flanders would be that bothered.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. And you can still get 25% off all your Science in Sport products with the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. That's SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. This week's question for the Science and Sport experts comes from Simon Bloomfield. And if you've got a question, please email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, or leave us a voice memo on our WhatsApp number. You'll find that on our Twitter profile. Simon Bloomfield asks about cycling nutrition and supplements for children. My 13-year-old daughter is an up-and-coming junior road cyclist, and we're increasingly doing longer rides together, now upwards of 80 to 100 kilometres. I'm conscious of getting a better handle on what the best approach is for her, both during a ride and for her recovery. Any advice? Thanks, Simon. Over to you, Ben Samuels.
Hi Simon, thanks for the question. So fueling the adolescent athlete is a complex topic for sure. The most important aspect to focus on is a strong whole food approach to meet the demands of growth, development, maturation and sports performance. Specific sports nutrition products can then be used as an addition as required. In terms of fueling during a ride, try and develop a proactive approach to nutrition whereby your daughter is eating and drinking at regular intervals. That can be a combination of fluids, whole foods such as bananas, energy bars, or Science in Sport isotonic energy gels. Out on the bike, that could look like a banana, a gel, and 1 to 2 bottles over the course of a 2-hour ride. Focus on frequency of fueling and maintaining consistent energy levels throughout the ride, as opposed to going through those massive peaks and troughs that we often see. Post-ride recovery should still include a couple of key nutrients, namely protein and carbohydrate. Try and achieve that through a couple of different eating occasions. So you're looking for something immediately post-ride, flavoured milk works fantastic as a recovery drink in that age group, and then a meal within the next 1 to 2 hours.
Well, Lionel, as you mentioned in your news roundup, a big story at the weekend, and it sort of erupted while you were in Belgium, initially concerning Stefan Denifel, the Austrian rider who won a stage at the Vuelta in 2017, riding for Aqua Blue Sport. Had signed for CCC for this year and then pulled out of that contract over Christmas for personal reasons. He never elaborated on what those were. He was outed on Sunday as having blood doped, and then the next day George Preidler, who rode for Groupama FDJ last year and for Team Sunweb before
pronunciation
that.
Pronunciation police, chaps. Pronunciation police. Georg.
Yeah, Georg, well, I think that he's one of those guys who, when I asked to introduce himself, said his name is George.
I think he's demonstrated you can't believe a word the guy says. So.
But but some will translate their name to the pronunciation, you know, of the country person he's been to. Anyway,
sorry,
but George Preidler. I mean, a very bad week for Cycling Podcast Pedlar de Charme Award.
Yeah, both former winners.
Both former winners.
What do we do?
There's no protocol for this. We don't know whether to revoke it, whether
what
to
would that law look like?
Send them each a jiffy bag requesting the garment be posted back. Anyway,
what happens when one of them posts a picture on social media in a few days of him reclining on his chaise longue, looking up admiringly at his framed Pedlar de Charme?
Well, there was a really arresting photograph of one of the cross country skiers caught mid blood transfusion, which. The banality of it was just shocking. He's in a sort of hotel room with his arm kind of having blood either taken out or put back in. And that was leaked, that photograph, by the police. It obviously shouldn't have been, but you can't unsee the picture. And it was a really shocking photograph. I'm imagining a similar photograph of somebody wearing a Pedlar de Charme t-shirt. It wouldn't be a good look, would it, for Pedlar de Charme? So we'll have to go back and look at our protocols for Pedlar de Charme. But it is a shocking story because those are perhaps two of the riders. You made this point on Twitter, Daniel. You can never know, obviously, but Preidler in particular, he's ridden for a Team Sunweb that really defines itself almost by its ethical policy. And I spoke to Larry Warbass on Monday, who's a former Aqua Blue Sport teammate of Denifel, and was quite good friends with him. He was even more shocked by the Preidler revelation because, again, he felt like he was somebody he knew a little bit, very friendly, an educated guy. One of the last people he would have expected to be blood doping, I think. I'm not putting words in his mouth. That's That's what he said. And, you know, he knows him better than we do. But the identity of these two riders is sort of particularly shocking, I think.
Well, I mean, Dennerfield, you look back at that thrilling stage he won in the Vuelta in 2017, Los Machucos finished, really steep concrete uphill finish where he was holding off Alberto Contador, dramatically giving Aqua Blue a stage win in their first Grand Tour. Obviously then the 2018 season for all the Aqua Blue riders was one of disappointment after disappointment, really. Very little in the way of a real elite racing for those riders. And then Dennerfield got a contract with CCC, which has risen from BMC Racing. Now, on Sunday morning, I went to find Jim Okovic, the boss of the CCC team, just to get his reaction. And this is what he said.
I heard about it last night, actually. Some report was out about the some investigation that went on in Austria with other sports, and he was involved in it as a cyclist. So that, I heard about it last night.
So when he said he was not going to take up his place with the team, I mean, what was that conversation like? And
I can't go word for word, but it was basically a family issue that he was having. I didn't go in a lot of detail because family is not my business. Sports is my business. He just said he couldn't continue his racing career. He had family issues that he had to deal with, and I accepted that as a reasonable explanation.
And so, from your point of view, are you glad that the team wasn't caught up in this?
Well, come on. You have to ask that question. It's, of course, we don't condone anything like that. We would never want to be involved in it. We were not involved. He never had any activity with us at all, zero.
In terms of doing your due diligence on signing riders, I mean, did you look at biological passport data or anything?
Everybody, yeah. Our medical team examines that. We look at background. We never heard of any issues he ever had as a racer. And he's been racing for more. He's not a rookie. He'd been racing on other teams. He came from teams that competed in events that we competed in. And he never had an issue that we knew of. So there was no red flag that went up and said, oh, boy, we better not sign this guy.
Does that worry you? Because obviously he was up to no good and there was no red flag.
I can't answer that because I don't really know the details of what he was accused of or what he might be involved in. So that's not a question I can answer.
And finally, in terms of, you know, the impact on the team and on the sport, I mean, he's not currently racing, so it minimizes the reputational damage. But every time the narrative is that it's one bad apple, but every time it's the sort of the sport reacts in the same way. Oh, it's another bad apple. I mean, what do you think this is indicative of what is going on inside World Tour teams at the moment, or is it?
No, of course not. It's got nothing to do with the World Tour team. He never got there, so I really don't know what he's even accused of or what he might have been involved in. So I think you have to go through that process first before you start throwing innuendos or criticisms about World Tour cycling, because it has nothing to do with it.
I think the interesting thing from Okovic there is that the sense was that, you know, the team wasn't tainted by this because he never got to pull on the jersey. Okovic, his point of view was that Dennerfield had pulled out of his contract for personal reasons. No real indication to doubt Okovic on that. But when I then asked whether this says anything about the culture within the World Tour, and Okovic said, well, hey, do you even have to ask that question? Well, clearly, 24 hours later, we know that a World Tour rider, Preidler, riding for Groupama FDJ, caught up in the same blood doping scandal. And so who knows anything? Who really knows anything? Do we take Okovic at his word and say, well, he either knows nothing, or, I mean, this is a big puzzle for me. Well,
I think it's a massive moment in the history of the recent history of anti-doping and doping in cycling, in the sense that, you know, it's 2011 was the last time we had any real major evidence of blood transfusions taking place. That was when the Italian rider Riccardo Ricco was exposed as having tried a bit of a DIY blood transfusion. And prior to that, of course, we'd had Operación Puerto in 2006. But since then, there had been nothing of that nature. You know, we'd had a sort of semi-regular series of positive tests for EPO, but we've said many times in the last couple of years that we're very unclear about what's going on. And I think, you know, I was contacted spontaneously by a couple of riders over the weekend, and they said how shocked they were, and they wondered whether they'd been naive, because they thought that blood transfusions were probably a thing of the past, at least as far as the vast majority of the peloton, if not all of the peloton, was concerned. And I think part of the reason why people were under that apprehension was that it was so traumatic when those revelations about Operación Puerto and Ricco, and even in 2008 with Bernhard Kohl, when those revelations were made, and it was so sort of squalid that I think, you know, as well as the peloton in general just cleaning itself up, there was a feeling that they would never go back there. We would never plumb those depths again. And if that was going to happen, it certainly wasn't going to be too sort of, you know, charming, well-spoken, seemingly upstanding guys like Georg Preidler, who and Stefan Denifield. Preidler, who'd ridden, Rich, as you said, for a Team Sunweb, who have almost become notorious for the severity of their checks and surveillance on their riders, to the extent where, you know, there've been reports or stories about them even checking their riders' belongings to make sure they hadn't, you know, brought doping products with them to races. So I think it's huge, and it does raise massive questions about what's going on now, and it raises.
On that, we should say that if we're to take Preidler at his word, and clearly there's a problem with that, he says that he had blood removed in 2018 when he was a Groupama FDJ rider. He has not said certainly that he was doping when he was at Team Sunweb. So it's possible, you could imagine, you know, certainly if you were Sunweb, you could say, well, their controls and their checks and their balances might have worked, as far as we know.
But on that point,
100%.
On that point, Daniel, I mean, Okovic there, on the one hand, saying they'd done their due diligence on Denifield, checked out his bio passport data, hadn't seen any red flags, and then when this comes up, still maintaining confidence in both their checks and the biological passport. I mean, it doesn't all stack up, does it? I mean, there's clearly gaps in the system here which can be exploited, and you know, the tripwire is not being tripped.
Well, just a bit of history on that line, on the biological passport. It was launched it was adopted by cycling in 2008. It was adopted by other federations after that. But I think, you know, gradually people have come to realise that it's not foolproof, and there are ways that you can get around the biological passport. I mean, 5 months after it was launched in 2008, the UCI came out and said they were already monitoring 23 riders, or there were 23 riders whose profiles warranted extra surveillance. And I think that created the expectation that, you know, this was going to be this sort of secret weapon that was going to take out all of the cheats in the peloton. It was going to completely eradicate not only blood doping, but also EPO doping. And I think over time, I think the UCI themselves, WADA, and the public with them have come to realise that it was never going to be that. We should never have had those expectations. It's been an incredibly useful tool. It served to inform the UCI and really inform their target testing. And, you know, if you speak to people who have intimate knowledge of how the passport works now, they say that, you know, it has yielded a lot in terms of the EPO positives that it's yielded, because riders have been targeted on the basis of their passports. But as far as transfusions are concerned, so autologous transfusions, transfusing one's own blood, they've realised. I mean, I spoke to someone, as I said, with intimate knowledge of how it works a couple of years ago, and one big problem they've recognised is that the physiology of professional cyclists is quite different and reacts quite differently to that of other athletes. And the one main reason for that is that something exists in cycling which doesn't exist in other sports, and that's stage racing. That's a sort of 5, 6, 7 hours of stress on an athlete's body every day over a period of days. And in Grand Tours, that's 3 weeks. And this really wreaks havoc with blood values and an expert's ability to read and interpret the blood values, and it particularly creates problems for something called plasma volume. Or plasma is basically the white sort of the tippy tappy stuff in the blood that
wishy washy
doesn't
stuff.
That doesn't do a whole lot, but it skews then hemoglobin and it makes it very difficult to read. And this is something that came to light when Roman Kreuziger was one rider who was initially fingered for his biological passport for values in two Grand Tours, actually, in 2011 and 2012. And it was in around about 2014 when the arbitration was taking place. And this was one of the issues that was raised, that it was very, very difficult to see what was going on there. And there is a school of thought that the UCI in particular was burned by the Kreuziger case, and thereafter there have not been many cases brought. In reality, there weren't many cases brought before that. There have been a lot in track and field. Up to the start of 2016, there were something like 70 cases brought in track and field, as against about 13 in professional cycling. But again, what I'm told is that has a lot to do with the increased difficulty of reading cyclists' profiles. There have been various other problems to do with it. I think that all the federations that have adhered to the passport have found data management to be a big problem. Huge numbers of these blood profiles, and very difficult to process it all, very difficult to read it. And I think as time has gone by, as I said initially, that the realization has really sunk in that this is a tool that can be used almost as an investigative tool rather than something that's going to catch people per se. And I think it's led indirectly to some very good things. For example, after the Kreuziger case, the UCI set up the CADF, which is the Cycling Anti-Doping Foundation, because they didn't want national federations to be deciding on sanctions anymore. They wanted to have control of that themselves. There was another development shortly after that whereby WADA introduced something, a regulation whereby 60% of all tests in certain sports, in endurance sports, had to be EPO tests, and they had to be screening for erythropoiesis stimulating agents, so substances like EPO. And again, this is something that's added to, or that's contributed to, more riders, athletes being caught, but not strictly speaking directly via the biological passport. And I think there is a feeling that blood transfusions could, if the will is there, still present a major problem.
And the thing here is, again, it's not the sporting authorities that have brought this to light. It's a police investigation which has blown the lid on this. And we now wait to see whether this is the tip of a more significant iceberg, reports are that more athletes from a number of sports might well be implicated in this. One thing that is slightly different to the sort of 2006 blood doping, 2006, 2007, 2008, which was really the kind of the, it was the
watershed.
It was the watershed, wasn't it? It was year after year of really significant scandals encompassing dozens of riders. There's a different response from the peloton. I mean, Marcel Kittel, for example, wrote a very strong piece on his blog, which I thought was certainly worth a read. It's posted in English as well as in German. That's not really something that we saw 10 years ago, is it? Well, the response 10 years ago to all of this was everyone pretty much kept their heads down. I don't know, again, this is just purely sort of a sense, a feeling. But it kind of shocked me, really, that this could be going on with riders who, they came to the sport long after 2008, 2007. You know, they should have been products of a different generation, and yet this kind of behaviour as its tentacles have stretched into the sport again, and whether or not it even went away. I mean, it could be that the parameters have narrowed, the window of opportunity is smaller than before, but there's still plenty of opportunity for unscrupulous behaviour to go undetected.
Well, we'll keep an eye certainly on the Austrian blood doping story, and we do, I think, wouldn't be surprised if more names come out of that, but it's one we're going to be covering and talking about probably for at least the next few weeks. But that's all for this week, I think. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
Just before we go this week, I should mention my second favourite piece of correspondence that we got from somebody. I mentioned my hip surgeon last week, asking if he could get a 10% discount on a hip replacement. He said he doesn't actually need one at the moment, but always on the lookout for a bargain. So thanks for that email. And continuing our new tradition of thanking some of the friends of the podcast. And if you sign up now, of course, you can get Lionel's opening weekend podcast from Het Nieuws Baden Kerner, Brussels Kerner. And very good it is too. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. And among those who've signed up recently, Lionel, are...
Dave Casey, thank you very much, Dave. And Christian Moller-Nielsen.
And Rich, two more names from me, Andrew Kerr and Timothy Johnson. Thank you to both of you guys.
And thank you to Kenneth Chisholm and Where's Rob Hatch When You Need Him? Yathukulan Kankesson. Hope I've said that correctly. Thank you very much to all of you for your support of the Cycling Podcast.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.